I used to love my morning coffee until it stopped loving me back. The bloating, the discomfort, it just wasn't worth it anymore. Then I found Everyday Dose, coffee with benefits. It's real coffee blended with mushrooms, collagen, and nootropics. Now I get my morning ritual without the crash or the discomfort. The Black Friday sale is on. Get 61% off your first coffee plus starter kit, a free A2 probiotic creamer, and over $100 in free gifts. Plus, you could win $100 cash or even get your entire order refunded. Head to everydaydose.com/podcast or use code podcast at checkout.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to Comic Book Club. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
I'm Pete.
And we're coming at you with a special episode with two great guys that we love chatting with, Jacob Phillips and Chris Condon. Welcome to the podcast.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Hello. Yes, thank you for having us on.
Very excited to have you here. Very excited to talk about this book. So we are big fans of your work, both separately and definitely together, which is how we first got to know both of you. But you got a big book coming up as part of the DC Vertigo relaunch. It's called The Peril of Brutal Dark, an Ezra Cain mystery. It's coming out February 25th, 2026, which seems like a while now, but it's going to creep up pretty quickly, particularly with holidays. You can still order it from comic book shops. And Chris, we talked to you about this a little bit at New York Comic Con, but now actually as we're taping this, like an hour ago, they put up the solicits with the previews, so there's more info out there.
It's getting real.
It's getting real, real and coming up there. I know you've talked about this a lot, and you, I think, talked about this like on the panel at New York Comic Con, but this is something in various aspects you've been working on since high school, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty wild because it's, I had this idea to, I always loved detective stories and I also loved adventure stories. And I grew up with Jules Verne and watching Indiana Jones, and I know Jake did as well. And, I love the combination of those things seems like kind of a no brainer. And I mean, some of my favorite stuff like Lobster Johnson and Hellboy already kind of has that sort of hard boiled slash fantasy, science fiction, horror elements too. So I always loved that kind of stuff. And in high school, I came up with my own character and started working on a story that was then called United Clockworkers Union. And it was what would eventually become, I was drawing and writing it myself then, and it would eventually become Brutal Dark. I started it in high school, writing it and drawing it as a comic book myself. Then in college, in film courses, I started writing it as a screenplay. And then when Jake and I were put on hiatus because of that Texas Blood, we started doing it as a digital comic, exclusively for our Patreon, which we literally started the Patreon for Brutal Dark. And then we got busy with that Texas Blood, so we had to stop doing it. And then Chris Conroy reached out to us about 2.5 years ago about doing a Vertigo book, and specifically doing a book like this. And we jumped at the chance and we said, well, we already got an idea, and just presented this to them. You know, I mean, it helped that we had, you know, three short issues from our Patreon that we could show and kind of show an example of what it could be, even those were kind of rudimentary compared to what we're doing now. But it's a blast to see this come to fruition, and not only come to fruition, but come to fruition with Vertigo, as part of the first wave of books back. So it's kind of an incredible experience to see it come from, you know, drawing it and writing it myself in high school to see it now, you know, just, you know, completely just, I'm floored by it.
Jacob, what was it like to replace high school Chris as the artist?
It was some big shoes to fill. I've seen, like, I think like a couple of pages. I think like way back, you sent me, I think just like photos of the pages that you did back in the day. And honestly, like there's not so much with this version, but in the Patreon version, there was, it was like pretty much panel for panel what you'd done in those early pages.
Oh, that's funny.
So that was pretty cool. So I could literally compare like panel by panel. But yeah, like I think it's definitely compared to what we were, like Chris was saying, like what we were doing on the Patreon side of it, it's definitely grown into something more than it would have been if we'd just stayed there, I think. And it's nice to come back to it after like, 5 years of practicing making comics. So I think it's, it's 5 years better, which is quite nice.
Yeah. I mean, on that note, I'm very interested in the idea that you kind of had it in this rudimentary form. Then just to clarify for anybody who's know, Chris Conroy is executive editor over at DC Comics. He runs not just the new Vertigo line, but also Absolute and Black Label. So he's in charge of a lot of stuff over there right now. But
a lot of great stuff.
A lot of awesome stuff. Once he took it on, once he was like, okay, we're going to do this for Vertigo, what changed? Did you sort of scrap everything, start fresh? Did you use those bones or pick and choose? How was that process? Since, particularly Chris, this was sitting in your head for so long, how did you kind of like push it back and then say, okay, we're going to make this as a Vertigo comic for real this time?
Well, one of the things that has kind of always stuck with, I always had this, the whatever, I don't want to ruin it, obviously, but there's a pretty big ending. And I knew that this ending was going to be big, always knew it was going to be big, and I never really knew how I was going to do it. And so that was one of the most exciting things to me was, kind of wrapping my head around that when I was younger and doing it myself and trying to figure out how this stuff works. And then coming into this with, having, four books in the, in the bank with Jake. So, I mean, looking at that and saying, okay, well, how can we kind of, move this forward and move ourselves forward and try to stretch our muscles and do something we've never done before. So that was really exciting. But I mean, in terms of what, a lot of it has stayed, a lot of like the bones of it are the same, but it has definitely grown and certain parts of it have changed, but it largely what we did release through the Patreon, the bones of that are there and they remain. And I felt like that, that stuff wasn't terrible, but it was done by people that were amateurs, and now we are, we're like Jake just said, 5 years professionals. So we, coming at it from a different perspective now and looking back at that, we can kind of see like, okay, well that works and that didn't work. And this, so like there's certain things that have remained the same, but one of the things that has changed is the opening of the book. So some of the things have remained, but it's always fun to see those sorts of things, like to kind of pick things apart and see, okay, this hasn't changed at all. Why hasn't this changed at all? But this has changed and this has grown, but why did we make these choices then? Why are we making the choices now? I always think it's really fascinating to kind of look at that stuff. And I was talking about that Texas Blood with on another podcast the other day, and I was thinking about it. And it applies to this too, where I don't know how many creators have the opportunity to go back and work on things that they had done 5 years before. And so we're really in a really fortunate place to not only with Brutal Dark, but also with that Texas Blood, going back and applying our talents now, because we have grown, we have changed. I think we have gotten better as the years have gone on. And so it's kind of fun to see, us applying those skills to the work that we were doing half a decade ago.
Well, I tell you, the fun jumps off the page. It seems like you guys are having like such a blast with this. I mean, I was laughing out loud, like the old Tommy Gun kind of, you're going to get the copper moments are just like so awesome. Can you talk a little bit about like working together to kind of like, what are some of your kind of favorite panels or favorite moments in there? Because this really jumps off the page and seems like you guys are having such a great time with this.
Yeah. I'd love to hear what Jake says.
Yeah, like, I think, like Chris said a second ago, the opening of the book changed from what we did before. And that whole sort of opening scene, which we've seen a little bit of in the previews, but I don't think the full thing. But the sort of chamber that they go into and all that kind of stuff. Like drawing that was like unlike anything that I've done before, and like I really wanted to push the sort of scale of things as well. Because even though like working on Texas Blood and Enfield in particular, you've got the sort of wide vistas, and like getting scale into that is one thing, but like in terms of like internal scale as well, but also like the New York section where we've got the buildings, trying to sort of push that as much as I could and really stretch that muscle.
I did want to ask you specifically about that scale, because like you're saying, just to kind of lay it out for anybody who wasn't lucky enough to read it without spoiling anything, but like you do go from these ancient Egyptian sort of chambers to museums to New York cityscapes to more intimate scenes that are set in like a very classic noir detective office. So how do you tackle that scale? Like, what is your first step as an artist when, say, you're having Ezra Cade running through a New York City cityscape, swinging off of balconies, etc.?
Yeah. A lot of it is getting like decent reference for it, I think, is the start for all this sort of stuff. Because I think like everyone's got a vague idea of what that stuff looks like in their head, especially like New York. You know, you've got this idea, but actually putting that onto paper is a whole different thing, because you have to figure out how that all works. So I was trying to make everything as sort of believable as I could without going into, you know, hyper-realism and getting bogged down in those details. But yeah, we have like such a mix of locations in this, which is definitely, you know, it's really fun, but it's also challenging. And things like you know, there's the bit in the museum when they go into the back room and it's like this huge sort of storage facility, and getting stuff like that. I don't know how much I can say without really spoiling the reveal, but it's sort of like, you know, we've got stuff in there of scale to sort of build the scale into the image. You know,
you
in
can
a way.
Say that there's a woolly mammoth in our
I
think it's okay.
Okay, yeah. So there's a big woolly mammoth in the back room of this in the museum, but just having that in it and then have is already a point of scale. So like building out from that and trying to find something like that as your sort of like anchor in amongst it, and really like pushing the wide shot so it's not just loads of sort of mid shots, which is, you know, what I would, you know, ideally I just draw loads of mid shots all the time because they're like easy and fun. So like really making myself push that a little bit is it's been one of the things that I'm trying to like really go for in this book. Like every time we start something new, I usually set out new rules and like a new idea that I want to put into this, which I haven't done before. So like just in terms of scale, I'm drawing this twice up, which is the first time I've done anything like that. So the pages themselves are huge. So even just doing something like that, or like, I really want to put more black down on the page and things like that. And that all helps, I hope, build the world a bit more and flesh things out, but also keeps it, you know, fun for me.
Let me ask you a question about this, and maybe Justin was about to jump in as well, but this is something we're hearing from artists a lot lately, is drawing.
It's going big.
Yeah, everybody's going big. Everybody's drawing double size. And this is not to diminish what you're doing at all, but we talked to David Finch about Skinbreaker a couple of years back. Couple of weeks back. And there was somebody else, I'm blanking on who it is. Why do you think that is? Like, is it more of a focus on the art rather than just jabbing out pages right now? Is it something just you did and it's a coincidence? Or what's your take on it?
Yeah, I think, interestingly, I went to Thought Bubble Comic Convention last weekend, and I had pages from Everything Dead and Dying, which is at the moment, which I'm also doing twice up. And there was an art rep there, and he's like, "Oh yeah, collectors hate it though." Like they want everything like the same size because they've got everything else that size. And I was like, I don't care about.
Yeah, that's crazy. I would want it bigger. Always.
Yeah. But I guess if you've got thousands of pieces or whatever, it's like everything's slotted away nicely, and it's. So I understand, but I'm like, I don't care about that at all. I'm trying to make the best page, and I found that I was struggling to get the inks to look how I wanted on a, you know, on a one, you know, sort of like 1.5 times up usually, or whatever I would normally do. It wasn't like, because my stuff's relatively, you know, crudely inked, so I was sort of struggling to get that detail. And I was like, this feels like I could push that a bit further while still doing the same, you know, I'm still working at the same size when I'm but it shrinks down more, if that makes sense. So it was mostly just that. It was like a practical way of getting around that issue without having to go digital, because when I'm going digital, I'm zooming in even more. And I also just don't like doing it, inking as much digitally. So it was, and it's just, you know, something different to try and keep it interesting for me. Because, you're putting out hundreds and hundreds of pages of this stuff. So it's... eventually you're going to have to mix it up a little bit. And even with that Texas Blood, I changed it every arc. I drew it in a different way. So like the first arc is all digital. The second arc is sort of half digital, half traditional. And then I went back to digital again. And it just depends on like what the story is. And also, you know, when I was trying to decide whether or not to do the third volume, traditionally or digitally, it came down to the fact that I needed to start inking that day and I hadn't bought any new pens, so I was like, well, I've got to do it. So sometimes there's a reason, sometimes there's literally no reason at all. So it just, yeah, it keeps it interesting for me to try and mix things up a bit.
And Chris, you're writing this on a giant laptop.
Yes.
Yeah, twice big.
Jump, you have to jump from key to key.
the big piano keyboard.
Yeah, it's a Dick Spring typewriter.
I mean, seriously, though, does it, knowing the different ways that Jacob is tackling the art, does that change how you're approaching the writing? I mean, obviously, you're trusting him as the artist, you have a good relationship, but does it affect the scripting process at all?
I mean, I didn't know necessarily how he was going to be doing when I wrote it, because I'd written it before he started work on it. But I will say that the way that I wrote it, I think definitely informs that choice, because, like I said, there's some very big moments. The scale kind of goes off the charts in terms of what we've done before. And I told Jake, I mean, when I sent him the script, one of the final scripts, I told him, like, if we do this right, this can be iconic. So like, let's like, and I feel like that was like part of the thinking was, you know, this can be big, this can be huge, like, and this can be an image that will stay in people's minds. And I think that, you know, especially with the scale, I think that could be, you know, that's something that I definitely think comes across in the art.
It feels like the story is, like we've talked about, sort of at the crossroads of detective and adventure, Indiana Jones style adventure story. What's it like being, like, how do you pull from both of those sort of micro genres the same, besides woolly mammoths, obviously? Like, how do you pull what you want from either one and make, combine them?
I mean, it's pretty easy for me because I just, these are the things that I love and I've always loved them, and it's so fun to I mean, I love the idea of this sort of noir detective who, you know, typically, I mean, you would just expect to see them in like shadowy back rooms or in bar rooms or, you know, all like sort of these you know, tight noirish settings. And then to kind of throw him into this larger world, a more fantastical world, I think is really kind of fun and exciting, and you know, it's fun to get to see the reaction of that character to those sorts of things happening. And kind of it stretches what the detective can be and what his you know, what his services can be, and just the character and his reactions to things. So, I mean, he's experienced larger things before. He was a detective. He was a veteran of the First World War. He went to college. Yes. So
I feel like you mostly that's what I like starting in like the genre. Like he looks like what you expect him to look like, but then I feel like it's you get to know him sort of very naturally over the course of the first issue because he's like, I actually did these things, and it feels very much like you're meeting him in a really
He's worldly for sure. But yeah, his decisions in life have informed where he is now, and I think that's incredibly relatable. That the things that he was setting off to do when he was a younger kid, in his early late teens, early 20s, wound up going to the wayside, and he became what he is now. And I find that incredibly relatable because, while I've always kind of been doing this stuff, I never really thought that I would be here doing, I always thought that I would be, I don't know what I thought I would be. So it's really interesting to get to write that character and to, play with that idea of, him being in two worlds, kind of in a way. And I think that it's also speaks to that period, which is, this period of transition, the First World War or the Second World War kind of informed, that what the second half of the 20th century would be, and then the 21st century in terms of technology and everything, basically. I mean, the atomic bomb, how that informed so much of the 20th century and the power and hierarchies and all that. So it was really interesting to get to play with that kind of the pre-World War II 20th century and then the post-World War II 20th century and just kind of seeing that and playing with that a little bit in the book.
Jacob, what about the look of Ezra Cade? I was definitely getting a big sense of Clark Gable throughout there. Yeah, that was kind of what you're calling.
Yeah, Clark Gable was the sort of starting point. And then as it always happens is, because I shoot proto reference for everything that I'm drawing. So it ends up looking a little bit like whoever I'm meant to look like, and then like a little bit like me. A good example of it was when I did Megalopolis. I was sort of drawing Adam Driver, but based on me, it ended up looking somewhere between the two, which looks exactly like my brother. So that was that was quite weird.
Realization there.
Yeah, did your brother have something to say? Like, hey, man, like, don't put me in all your stuff.
He doesn't look at what I do. he's busy, Clark Gable was definitely the starting point, and sometimes I'll sort of come to that by myself, or sometimes Chris will have it in the script, like, oh, this looks a bit like so and so, or I was thinking maybe along these lines, or ignore that and do what you want. So there is often actors in mind, but you don't want to go too close as well, because it can be distracting, I think, as a reader to be like, oh, that's that's whoever, and it looks like you've just cast them as that. So it's trying to find that sort of, like, you get the vibe, but without it just being like a slave to looking at photos of Clark Gable. You want to capture the sort of essence of them, I think, more than a likeness.
One of the aspects of the series we haven't talked about yet is some of the Vertigo books are going to be just like ongoing, monthly, going forever. This kind of is, but kind of isn't, because you're going to be doing these in 6-issue novel-esque chunks, right? What led to that decision? Why was that important? I mean, I think I can intuit why, but I'd love to hear from you.
I mean, I think that's just how we work, to be honest. I think that, we've been doing that for that Texas Blood and the Enfield Gang Massacre, and it just felt like the right way to do this as well. And also the fact that each arc is sort of built as, so this arc is called Peril of the Brutal Dark, and then the next one will be called whatever the next one is going to be called. So they're each kind of their own things. They're their own stories. And I think that doing them as these chunks, it allows people to catch up on them and read them, but it also allows us to catch up and do other things, so we're not just, doing one book for 5 years, we can branch out and do other things. So that's part of the reason. But I don't know, Jake, you want to weigh in on why we do this?
Yeah, also I think just like signing yourself up to a 12 issue a month, a year run that just keeps going is a really good way of just completely burning out as well. As like, as an artist, I think like you can't sustain that for long. You know, that's why so many books have got people that come in and fill in for an issue or two here and there. And I'm a quick, you know, I do it quickly. I draw quickly, but I also, I'm also coloring it. And it takes time, and it's, this alleviates some of that pressure as well. And I think it's nice because it keeps these stories separate as well. It's not just an ongoing thing. And hopefully it makes it slightly more like an event when the new one comes. I think there's a load of reasons why it works, you know, like, TV shows do it, you know, they've always done it. you need this time to make the work, otherwise the work itself will suffer, I think. And we have other ideas. Also,
I was going to say, it's also built in the same way that like the Sam Spade novels or the Continental Op or the Raymond Chandler, Philip Marlowe, all those stories are kind of built in the same way where each novel is its own thing. It's a continuing adventure with that character as you read the different books, but you know, each story is its own thing. It's its own whole. And I think that was also part of our thinking. I'll say that at least.
Yeah. Maybe I'm wrong about this, but when we last talked, Chris, you said that you guys have been working on this for at least 2 years at this point. Yeah. So given that Peril of the Brutal Dark is that story you wanted to tell since high school, I imagine you're beyond that now. What is it like getting to expand that world, sort of like jump off that cliff and take it even further?
Well, I mean, I haven't started writing the next stories, but I know what I want to do. I kind of sent some rough ideas to Conroy and our main editor, Matt Levine. And they really loved them. And I know Jake really loved the second one because it would take place in London. Ooh, so he can travel and take pictures and do all that. So, it's great fun to kind of see, you know, for years and years and years, it was just this one story and like, well, what would that be going forward? You know, what would be another story with this character? Where would he be after this story ends? And so that's kind of a really fun thing to get to play with and think about. And I feel that way about, you know, doing, you know, something like that Texas Blood or even Green Arrow or, you know, any of these stories. You know, where do we go? Because you might come in with one story. Like for Green Arrow, I came in with Freshwater Kills and I had nothing after that. So it's okay. Well, what is the next thing that we're going to do? And then kind of, you know, thinking about in terms of that, it's like you start building out this roadmap and, it's really fun to get to play with that and get to think about, well, this would be really exciting to see. This would be really cool to see. And this would be interesting for the character to dive into this backstory or this, you know, and that's really great fun to get to do and get to work into the back matter as well, which there is going to be back matter. Okay. In Peril of the Brutal Dark.
I would expect nothing less.
I would kind of like to expand upon something you mentioned before that I find interesting is like, you know, you have an idea, you get to do it, and then you got to start all over again. Like when you're kind of like, okay, how do we draw or make up the next adventure? What do you start with? Do you start with like things you love about the character? Like how do you kind of pull something out of nothing?
Well, one of the things that I was looking at more than anything is just, I mean, the time period and places where interesting things were happening. Okay. This is, New York in 1941 was an interesting place. And I, you know, if, you know, what happened in Hawaii, Pearl Harbor happened in December of 1941 and, you know, that's obviously the Western front. And then, so what happens on the Eastern front, with everything that's going on in Germany? And there were reports of submarines and, you know, off the coast of New Jersey and things like that. So it's interesting to get to play with the ideas of, you know, what could be happening in New York at that time period. And then, you know, going into London, like I was saying for the next one, I mean, you know, it's no secret that there was the London Blitz. And that would be the setting for the next story. So, you know, thinking about those kinds of things, looking back at history, that's kind of what is informing our choices and what we, you know, what, why we're doing what we're doing.
Yeah. What
was it like at the for you, Chris, at the Vertigo panel at New York Comic Con, which is like the big rolling out? And what does it feel like to just be part of this new launch of Vertigo?
I mean, it's crazy. I felt like it was crazy when we were first asked to do it. And then it was such a long process because
yeah. You can't be hyped pretty, for like one full year.
Yeah. So we were like I think we were the first ones asked back or asked to be part of this. And then, after a while we were like, is it happening? Is it not happening? And so we're just like, it's one of those things that eventually now it's happening and it's going to be this thing with, you know, Dennis is doing his thing and Kyle's doing his thing. And then they're going to do more 100 bullets, you know, and then there was a lot of things that were very exciting, and to be on that panel was really cool. I was very nervous, and thank God it's Kyle Starks next to me because he's much better with a crowd.
He was hyping me up.
Nice. He's great. His book is great, and you know, but it was so exciting to be a part of that and just to know that we were part of this relaunch of Vertigo. I mean, that's such a special thing, you know, it's such an important part of, and so many of people of, you know, our age range, and Vertigo was such an important imprint. Yeah. I mean, all of the titles, I mean, one of the first things I remember about going into a comic shop was seeing a Preacher poster on the wall. And that is like cemented in my brain is like, that's what comics are. Is this, I don't know what this thing is, but a priest to me was never that. And I was like, what is this? I want to find out. And that, so it was such an important part of my comic book reading life. And to be a part of that now, with our own series with a character that I created in high school, it's wild. I don't know. I keep feeling like, doing comics is like, you know, I continuously am having my dreams come to fruition. And it's a wild thing to see and to know that it's true. It's not a dream. It's actually happening. You gotta
dust off your elementary school comics.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of how I, you know, that's the well I keep going back to is, well, yeah. What did I do in a, you know, what did I do in elementary school? What did I do in preschool?
Mom, so. Quick, tell me.
Marvel needs something right now. I did want to ask you about a couple of other projects you guys have going. Jacob, you mentioned Everything Dead and Dying, which is this awesome, unexpected zombie story. Really beautifully done, really heartbreaking throughout. But I did want to focus on one aspect you mentioned.
So freaky
Pip
and scary.
Martin is coloring you there versus... here on Peril of Brutal Dark, and I think with Texas Blood, you were killing yourself. So how does that change your process when you're doing something like Everything Dead and Dying and you know you're doing everything up to the colors versus you're doing the colors as well?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting one because I don't think it changes much in the way that the finished artwork looks. I think that's pretty much I have the level that I do it to, and then it's the rest is left to the color. But I think it changes my approach in the fact that I don't know what I'm getting from Pip, really. Like, you know, we go back and forth on some things and
never know.
Never know. Yeah, she's crazy.
Everything's green.
Yeah. But when I'm coloring myself, I can kind of just be like, okay, I know what I'm going to do with that later on. And that's built into how I'm making the page. You know, there's stuff. I've just started inking the final issue of Brutal Dark today. So I was looking back through the pencils because I did them about a month ago. I'm like, okay, right, I remember this. And I know what I'm doing with the color in that as well. So it's sort of built into the whole process. Whereas with Everything Dead and Dying, when I hand it off, it's slightly more... if it's interesting because it's like, because I've always colored my own stuff and I obviously color stuff for my dad as well. It's like, I already have a preconceived idea of what I would do. So when I get it back, it's always a surprise, which is quite nice. Because even if it's similar, it's still not going to be the same as what I would have done. Which is nice. And you know, that's the joy of working in comics is that it's so collaborative. Like, you know, I have an idea of what, you know, the next arc of that Texas Blood's going to be, which Chris has, you know, just started writing. But, you know, I have like, he's told me like, you know, a 3-sentence sort of summary. It's not like, I know the ins and outs. So when I read the script, it'll be a nice surprise. Yeah. So it's constantly, yeah, like a pleasant surprise, no matter, you know, who you're working with. Hopefully, anyway, that's the aim. but yeah, it doesn't really, I don't think it changes the artwork, but it definitely changed my approach slightly, I would say.
Yeah. Chris, jumping over to Green Arrow number 30 comes out as we're taping next week on November 26th. But then the final issue, Green Arrow 31, is coming out on December 24th. I don't want to spoil anything, but we did get a chance to read it in advance. And it's a really beautiful, lovely send off to the book. Very emotional, very poignant. While we kind of get like the action wrap up next week, and then we get the emotional wrap up the month after. How far in advance did you know that the series is ending, or were you able, I guess I'm just curious, like, since it does feel like a very final note in Green Arrow 31, how were you able to craft that?
Yeah. So, I mean, first of all, thank you very much. It became like a heartfelt, I wanted it to be,
it was beautiful. Thank you for it. It's,
yeah,
it's
thank you
so
very much.
Touching. It was, great way to start.
I've not read it, so I don't know.
Yeah. Well, when you do, you'll so love it.
You'll like it.
Hate
you'll
it.
Like, you should check it out.
I'll send it over to you. But yeah, so I mean, I knew for a couple, maybe a month and a half, something like that, going into it, that it was, the book was ending. So I knew that it was going to end, and I knew that I wanted to do something that was going to feel like it was a worthy ending, that it was a good conclusion. Cause obviously, you know, though we could have gone on for longer if, you know, we were given that chance, you know, I did feel like we had 14 or 13 good issues at that point. You know, we told stories that we wanted to be telling and people weren't enjoying it. And I wanted to do right by the readers. And so I was trying to think of what would be a good send off. And, you know, I was looking back at what Josh did and, you know, do I go back to kind of where he started his arc? So there were some thoughts about going back to the island and, you know, sort of things like that. And I was, you know, toying with the ideas of what it should be, what it could be. And then I got an email from the editor asking for the solicit text. and I said, this is what the book will be. And I just sent it off and didn't really, it was kind of vague. And the reason it was vague is I didn't really have the full thing kind of fleshed out. And, but I thought that there was a good starting point, in terms of the what the themes would be going into it. And then sitting down to actually write the issue, I started writing it. And the way that it was going, it became a different book than what I thought it was going to be. Oh, wow. Which is, I think, how the best issues that I've ever done, that Jake and I have done. I mean, I think this is certainly the case in the Texas Blood and the Anfield Game Massacre as well. Is that, you know, I don't necessarily find that the best issues are the ones that are tightly outlined. I find that the best issues are the ones where the characters and the moments drive the story and take you to places that you didn't necessarily expect, but they feel organic because they are organic. And as I was writing the issue, I started realizing that I was talking about comics and superheroes. Well,
that's what I was
and what
say,
they mean like, to me.
It feels like we don't ever get stories like this in comics where there are like conclusive, like definitively conclusive, emotional, and like, and sort of defining, like it really feels like your statement or Green Arrow's statement on what it means to be doing that, even though he's not aware of what's happening until, I don't want to say much more, but not aware of what's happening until sort of almost the end of the story. So yeah. Like that, and to hear you say that it came out organically feels wild to me, because it feels like such a capstone, like a purposeful capstone.
Yeah. I mean, it really wasn't planned, and that I, again, like those are the best issues I think that I write are the ones that it, you know, not to be hokey, but the ones that come from the heart, you know.
Yeah.
So it's just, you're just sitting there writing it and it's like, okay, this makes sense next, this makes sense next, this makes sense next, and it was just flowing in a certain way that it's like, okay, I'm just gonna I'm gonna go with the flow. I'm just gonna see where this takes me. And the fact that you have a deadline also. but yeah, I really wanted to. I mean, this was a really important character for me. And when I was asked to do the book, I thought it was the perfect character to be offered, because this was, I remember reading the O'Neill and Adams Green Arrow in high school and having them really make an impact on me and kind of show me that, comics aren't just, Ultimate Spider-Man, there's a lot that you can do with it. You can talk about, things that are happening in society, even if that was, 50 years out of date or 40 years at the time or whatever, but it's, I really connected with that book and I loved the character and, would go on to continue loving that character in the Mike Grell work and in year one, Andy Diggle and Jock and, and then even in Justice League Unlimited and just feeling so such a connection to that character and wanted to do right by that character. And I think that helped inform the ending as well. Cause I don't know if every book is going to have that sort of capstone sort of feel to it. I mean, just cause
yeah,
sometimes it's, I don't know. There was just, there was something in the book and what we were doing and what I was doing specific that I felt like it was just like, it was all kind of coming to a point and it was coming to a point for a reason. And it kind of all just flowed into the book.
Well, you killed it. You did exactly. You. It was just so well done, so beautiful. I would like to change gears a little bit, talk about how great things are when they come together. Jacob, I'm a little mad at you because your art is so good. The last issue of everything, Dead and Dying is so scary. It gave me nightmares. That cover, the zombie kid, was so creepy. Do you have any kind of worry when you make something that's so powerful and so, like, oh man, I'm creating a monster and now I'm releasing it out into the world? Do you claim any responsibility for that?
How do you sleep at night? Is what
yeah, thank you, Justin. Thank you. Because I can't, because your art is so good. It freaks me out.
No, I don't think about it at all. The image for the cover, I think I actually came up with the image for the first cover. I'd already tried it once and for some reason we didn't go for it. And I was like, oh, I do think it's like really cool though. So I can't remember why we didn't go for it in the first place, but yeah, we finally managed to get it in for issue three. And I'd done this really good sketch of that, and then I couldn't find it. Like, I couldn't find the specific reference that I used for it. So I was trying to recreate it, and it just happens, all the time, where it's like, I'll do a thumbnail or whatever, and it looks great. I'm like, okay, now I need to capture that in the final thing, and it doesn't work. So I'm glad that it at least came out looking like it did, even though it's not quite as good as I think it maybe should have been.
I don't know.
I'm very much an it'll do kind of artist, because mostly because I think comics means you have to be if you want to, hit deadlines. Some people don't necessarily care and will spend the time that it takes and the book will be late. But I find that if I do that, then that knocks onto everything else and I end up a year behind. So it's, most of the time I don't really think about anything that I'm doing past the point of doing it. I don't really sit with it and be like, okay, how will people receive this or, anything like that. I don't even sit down and read the issue when it's done. I just sort of, they show up and I never really look at it again.
Push them right in the garbage can, just like right off the desk.
That's not entirely true. Because I know that you guys were the cow. Yeah, I know that you guys were like, you guys wanted that cow to be kind of the image of the book.
but that was Tate, not me.
Okay.
Tate had the original image on the issue one image of the zombie cow. We had that. That was the only. We did a version of that for the pitch, which was like just like an inked version. But everyone really liked the sort of imagery of the zombie cow being milked. So we reused it for the cover, and I do think that's sort of it's worked very nice. I think it nicely sums up the tone of the book, and
agreed.
And it was something that I hadn't really seen before, which is fun. And you know, I think the whole book is like when Tate asked me to do it, I was excited to work with Tate anyway because he's a friend. But when I read the pitch, it was like, oh yeah, this is exciting, because I've not really seen anything like this before. And from just what I've seen in terms of the response online, it's people seem to feel the same, which is nice.
Yeah.
But I've not had anyone tell me that it was too scary until now.
Pete gets scared very easily. Very easily. Not to keep jumping back and forth, but Chris, I did want to ask you, Green Arrow number 31 is coming out, and then other than the DC Vertigo stuff, which is creator-owned, that's going to be your last DC work for a while, right? Because you're Marvel exclusive now.
Yeah, Vertigo is carved out, so I'm going to continue doing Vertigo. So we're gunning forward in terms of what the next arc would be and when I'm going to get to writing this. So I have to work out the schedule with DC about that. But yeah, for a good chunk of time, this Green Arrow will be my last DC hero.
I imagine part of the reason is job security, but what led to the decision to go Marvel exclusive?
Yeah, I mean, part of it, a big part of it is job security. The other part of it is just, Marvel has been really fantastic at making me feel at home and welcome. And I feel like they say it a lot when you're there in the offices that it's like, part of a family. But I truly do feel like, especially Ricky Purdon and CB and Dan Buckley, all of them, they really do make you feel like that you're part of the family. And so it was kind of a no brainer for me to want to go over there and work with them. And the opportunities have been fantastic. And I think there's going to be a lot of really, really cool stuff and some stuff that I think will excite, creator owned fans of mine, as well, because there's some artists that I'm cooking up some ideas with that I think it's going to be really, really fun, and I'll tell you guys about it when we're
done. Cool. I know you can't talk about any specifics, but I am curious, when you get something like this, is there a sense of like, okay, now come in and you get to call your shot, you can finally do the Speedball book that you've always wanted to do, or is it just...
A little bit. Yeah, I came into it and they said, who do you want to work on? And I said, well, I want to do this, and I want to do this, and I would want to do this, and they said, okay. And then it seems like I'm going to be doing this.
Wow!
Yeah.
Wow!
So it's awesome. It's really cool. Yeah,
some I would always
Star Wars stuff, and yeah, so there's going to be a lot of like really cool stuff that I'm working on. I'm really excited about the stuff that like Kid Chris would kill me.
That's awesome.
So it's really, really cool, really exciting, and the opportunity is just fantastic. And I love DC, I love the DC family as well, but the opportunity just presented itself at Marvel, so I kind of had to jump at it.
Yeah. And we've taken up a lot of your time, but you did mention that Texas Blood is slowly coming back. I know that you posted, I think it was the first page of the script on social, Chris, at some point. No pressure. When could we expect that, given how busy you guys are?
So we are, we've said, and we're putting our foot down June.
Okay.
June All of right. 2026.
Great.
Awesome. And that gives us room in December of 2026 for our Christmas issue as well. So that was kind of the idea behind why we want to do June rather than July or another month. We were initially going to do March of 2026, but with Brutal Dark releasing in February, we didn't want to double up, because Brutal Dark was originally going to come out in March of 2025. Mm. And then they pushed it back to October of 2025. And then they pushed it back again because KO was going to be coming out, and they didn't want it to be, you know, overlapping with the Vertigo release. So, yeah, we ended up pushing it back to June, but June is going to be the month.
Awesome. Well, guys, looking forward to all this. Just a reminder for everybody, Peril of the Brutal Dark and Ezra Cain Mystery is coming out February 25th, 2026. But
check
you can
it out.
Order it at your comic book shop right now, and please do, because it's awesome. Guys, so great talking to you. Thanks for taking
time. Yeah, thank you so much.
Looking forward to the rest of the mysteries.
Yes, thank you for having us on.